Hello, I'm Mike Sainsbury, and welcome to this ASI cast, in which our research director, Richard Marks, speaks with the president and CEO of FIP, James Hughes. After describing the origins of the organisation, James talks about the way FIP has developed over the years and the services it now provides its members. Drawing on data from their Global Digital Subscriptions report, James and Richard discuss the success of the changing revenue models for publishers, and in particular, the relative importance of subscription and advertising revenue.
Hi, well, welcome to the podcast, James.
Thank you.
For the benefit of our listeners who may not be as closely connected to the worlds of news brands and magazines, what role does FIP play in the world of publishing?
Well, we're a very old organisation, and as you rightly say, our roots are in the magazine business. We've been around since the 1920s. We originally started as a way for publishers who were magazine publishers to meet one another on a regular basis, something that wasn't really happening in the early years of the magazine industry. But I think over the last 10 or 20 years, we've evolved now to become much more focused on delivering knowledge to the industry in terms of sharing best practice and case studies on the immense changes that the industry has gone through in the last few years, whilst retaining that core of networking, which is really what the organisation started around. So I think the biggest change for us, though, has been that whilst our history and our heritage is in the magazine industry, we've now broadened our remit to cover media companies more generally. So we don't just rely on straightforward magazine publishers to be our members. We have a broad range of members from across the media industry now, including organisations that have been in magazines and then exited them, people like the BBC, and people who were never really in them in the first place. You know, people like Red Bull, who do have a magazine as a marketing tool, but are fundamentally a soft drinks company. So we are quite broad in our membership. We do try to represent everybody who's not in the broadcast space. I think broadcasters are probably the only sphere, television and radio and cinema, that we don't operate in. But for all of our members, we're trying to do the same thing, which is to help them understand the what's happening in the media space right now and to take the best practice lessons from some of our members and apply them to their own business, and at the same time meet that one crucial person, that one crucial organisation who might make a difference to their company. I should also say that we tend to operate mostly with businesses that have a cross-border focus because we're a global organisation, we have members all across the world, and so naturally it falls to many of our members that they have an international focus in their business as well.
And that involves, obviously, education, organising, conferences, events, knowledge sharing.
That's right. So, we you know, I guess the two main forums for knowledge sharing are digital, in that we produce an increasing number of pieces of insight every year, one of which we're going to talk about in a minute, as well as maintaining a regular flow of news and information to members through the newsletter. And the other way that we disseminate knowledge is through conferences and events. We run the FIP Congress every year, which is a very large kind of gathering of the industry, happening this year in November in Las Vegas. And then we run a summit focused around innovation and digital media in March of every year in Berlin. So those are the two major events, both of which are pretty large, you know, 600 plus attendees. And then throughout the year, we will do a series of smaller tactical events in specific markets, depending on the need, to focus on individual areas of activity or to focus on individual companies, depending on what the need is.
We'll put a link to the FIP site in the show notes so you can see what's going on. Our event in Lisbon in September, at that event you'll be sharing the results of the latest Global Digital Subscription Survey. Now, online subscriptions and paywalls is a huge topic and a hugely important topic. How long have you been tracking that, and what key metrics do you track?
Well, we've been doing it for about 18 months now. We started it as an annual survey. We, to begin with, have treated it just as one of many insight pieces that we do every year. But I have to say that the response to it has been so phenomenal that we've had to increase the frequency to quarterly. So there'll be a release of new data in June, be another one in September, hopefully in time for me to present the results at your event. It has been the most well-received and popular piece of content we've ever done, frankly. The appetite for knowledge and interest around digital subscriptions is such that people are really hungry to get their hands on the metrics that we're producing. I would put a caveat around it, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later. we do measure volumes. We measure volumes of digital subscribers, and we try to take some measures of price. But there aren't yet any standards emerging in this space around what the, you know, common metrics should be across media companies for this kind of activity. So when we present the data, we do it. We try to put some analysis around it ourselves, but we also put a bit of a label on it, a red label on it for people to say, well, hang on a second, just be aware of the periods, just be aware of the data sources here before you start getting too kind of analytical with some of these results, because there isn't yet any commonality of metrics in this business.
Yeah, I was going to ask about metrics. The other thing I was going to ask about was getting access to the data. It may be that you've done this in the last 18 months, and that may be you're hitting a sweet spot where the subscriptions are starting to be sizable, because I can remember being involved in the project I worked on for Newsworks about 4 years ago. Trying to get hold of any figures at that point was quite tricky, because presumably at that point people were very defensive with me. Is it fairly easy to get publishers to tell you
it is? I mean, publishers are surprisingly willing to give you the data. Now, the caveat is that that's their data. So, you know, you have to, a bit like in the old days of print circulation, when we had the publisher's statement for printed circulation, you'd always take it with a pinch of salt. I'm sure that the numbers they're giving us are correct and are valid. And they have been surprisingly willing to do it. And I think that's a function of the fact that this is now becoming a major success factor for a number of particularly news publishers. I mean, if you look at the ones that are at the very top of the list, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the volume of subscriptions is now in the millions, and is now, in the case of some of those organisations, a major factor in their share price. And so, you know, the relative success or failure of digital subscriptions is a kind of critical success factor for the company overall, which means that they've had to be a lot more robust about the way they report it. So we're able to get figures from things like presentations from the stock market and in reports. Where those figures are not available in those cases, publishers are now increasingly willing to just volunteer them to us, because they want, in most cases, to show that their relative success is better than people thought. You know, we've had people come to us after the last report and say, well, hang on, you've underreported. Actually, we're better than that. And so, of course, we happily correct the figures the next time round. And I think that's very encouraging. It shows that there's a lot of success out there in the market, the fact that people are wanting actively to be part of the report. And I think that's something that is going to be very useful for the industry going forward. I would like to see the beginnings of some commonality of measurement emerge, because that would enable us to do better comparison. Having said that, though, the brute figures that we do get do give you a pretty good idea of, first of all, the relative success of the different media brands that are involved, obviously, but also the types of media that are successful at this, and also the countries and regions where this is successful. I think that, you know, you can draw quite a lot of useful data from that.
Does FIP, it's always strange to say, do organisations have views, or perhaps you have a view on, reading the report, it's fascinating. It does seem very keen on the idea that subscriptions are a good way to go. Are there any exceptions you'd make to that, or is it because it's interesting, in the last 5 to 10 years, the original view that an ad-funded model could suffice on the internet definitely seems to have been challenged. But is it now effectively the case that you would encourage members to consider a subscription model if they aren't already, or is it horses for courses?
It's partly horses for courses. I think if the only business you have in your organisation is ad-funded, that's probably not the most sensible approach for the future, because any business at any period in history really needs to be looking to diversify its revenue and therefore reduce its risk. And I think the rewards that were on offer, I mean, if you take the kind of very simple case of the newspaper industry in America, you know, the rewards that were on offer from advertising for so many years were so great that, frankly, anybody trying to do anything else in terms of revenue was ignored, because there was no need to worry about it. The newspaper industry, the one that we thought was going to be the one that went to the wall quickest, actually has been the one that's responded quickest to this challenge, and has taken up the gauntlet of digital subscriptions and done it very well, I have to say. And I think as part of that process, those organisations have recognised that they don't want to switch from dependence on advertising to dependence on subscribers. They may end up being dependent on subscribers by default, just because that's a very large proportion of their revenue, but they seem to be making active efforts to diversify into areas like events so that they've got other revenue streams coming along that would allow them to you know, weather any storms in any one of those fields. And I think that's the big lesson that we give to all of our media members, whether they're newspapers or magazines or actually digital pure play businesses. This applies equally to somebody like a BuzzFeed. If you want to be sensible, if you want to have a long-term view of your industry, you need to have a diversified approach to revenue. And digital subscriptions needs to be a part of that, but so does events, so does brand licensing, so does data rental. We identify, I think there's 12 business models that we've identified that media businesses now should be going after, and the recommendation is that you should have three or four of those in your plan. And if you've got three or four of them, you can then weather any storm in any one of them.
Is there do you perceive any difference between newspapers and magazines in terms of their ability to charge for an offer? Because on the one hand, basic news content is easier to find for free, so that's always been a challenge for journalism. On the other hand, magazines have typically a much lower frequency of publishing new content. So the value offer may seem slightly different for a magazine.
I think you've hit on a challenge there for magazine publishers. Perhaps it was a challenge, it's becoming less so now because they've ramped up their digital operations. The volume of content being produced by a magazine publisher was much less than a news publisher. The amount of original, did I say value? I meant amount. The amount of original content that they're producing was probably less. That's changing now. I do think that particularly specialist magazine publishers, are now producing, you know, significant quantities of original content that they can now start to charge for. But to answer your question, I think the difference is that news publishers were quicker, probably out of necessity, to jump with both feet into the digital subscription space and therefore have been quicker to see results. Magazine companies haven't done that yet. There isn't really, apart from The Economist, possibly The New Yorker, which are, you know, news and current affairs as well, there isn't really yet a shining example of success in a non-news and current affairs magazine publisher with digital subscriptions. Now, we're expecting that that's going to come along in the next year or two. Condé Nast have just put all of their magazines behind paywall, so you know, we'll get the results from that very, very soon. If you think about the women's fashion and high-end lifestyle space, Vogue will be the benchmark. You know, that will tell us what the propensity is of those consumers to pay for digital subscriptions. And that's a really useful benchmark that the rest of the industry can look to. So I think there is a difference in terms of time. There's a time lag. And newspapers are much further ahead in terms of the marketing and the technology and the success around this than magazine publishers are.
It's interesting you mentioned Vogue, because 20 years ago, possibly more, I used to do a lot of research for Vogue. And the thing is often forgotten in the conversation about programmatic trading and addressable advertising is the degree to which a lot of magazine readers actually value the advertising that's in their magazines. And it's interesting, particularly the video and the subscription video industry, there's a lot of debate going on there about whether it may become inevitable for companies like Netflix to have advertising. But it's all framed in the context of the fact that the advertising will be annoying, and therefore they talk about hybrid models of subscription plus advertising. I'm assuming that in nearly all the cases of the publications you're surveying here, they're by definition hybrid. There isn't an element of subscribe to this newspaper and you won't get any advertising.
I think there is an element of that. I take issue very slightly with what you're saying. You know, whenever I would run reader surveys in magazines, it was a running joke in the company that, you know, is there anything you don't like about a magazine? Too many ads. You would get it every single time.
It depends on the magazine, but certainly like the Vogue September issue.
It can add to the experience in certain cases. If you go into the digital space, I've never yet seen any research that suggests that any consumer in the digital space values digital advertising because we're so bad at it. I mean, it's just, you know, that's not a magazine thing. That's just the whole industry is terrible at it. And that's not me saying that. That's the consumer reporting back. The consumer hates it. So I think that a fundamental element of value proposition for a particularly high-end subscription service is the lack of ads. If, you know, Netflix would be insane to consider putting advertising in their subscription offering. I mean, absolutely mad, because that's what people are paying for, is not having to look at terrible commercials all the way through their program. I remember hearing a year ago, a very senior executive from, I forget which network it was in America, I think it might have been NBC, and talking about their forthcoming streaming service, where they were saying, well, we're going to do something different. We're going to make people pay and put ads in it. And there was literally an intake of breath in the room at the stupidity of that, you know, statement. I mean, the to me, if there is going to be advertising in these subscription models, and I can't claim to know every single one in the world, there are probably some people that are doing that, then it needs to be much less intrusive than it is right now, and needs to be very, very carefully selected, so that there's a certainty that it's enhancing the value proposition. I always take the Amazon view with these kind of things. Amazon's view would be, is this what the consumer wants? Yeah. And the answer is overwhelmingly no. So therefore, don't do it. You know, just don't do it. You don't see Amazon's Prime streaming service covered in ads because they know that's not what people want. Mm. It may be driving them to purchase in a very subtle way, but it's not covered in ads. And I think that's something that we've got to just get around. When I stand up and do presentations about media trends, as I do quite often at the moment, I say to delegates, advertising has never been less important to our industry than it is today. And that's probably a good thing because, you know, we had advertising as a way of solving a problem and that's gone away now. And so advertising can kind of stop being up here and holding my hand in the air for people who can't see me, you know, at the top of the industry, and just assume its place as one of many revenue streams that when it's appropriate, we will have it.
It's interesting. I'm often at TV events where an advertiser will say, well, yeah, effectively, we fund this industry. And you have to remind them that actually in the UK, it's currently, I think, 35% of UK television revenue comes from advertising. Because, you know, if you add in subscriptions, license fees, international sales, content rights, etc. As a result...
Just on that, I mean, I think, again, you've got to look at consumers. And I would say that, yes, out of necessity, our industry, the publishing industry, has been forced into this route. Because of what's happened to our consumer base. I think if you're sitting in the linear television industry and you're thinking advertising funds my business and always will, that's madness. Mm. You only have to look at kids and the way they watch television, well, the fact that they don't watch television anymore. My kids, and I hear this from, you know, every parent I meet, they watch YouTube. Mm. Now, yes, they're getting served advertising on YouTube, but the point is they're not watching linear television on a schedule dictated by some guy sitting in an office somewhere. They're watching television on demand, and it's not a big step from them at the moment as 10-year-olds with no purchasing power to go to 20-year-olds with purchasing power and going, I'm going to pay 10 quid and cut the ads out of that, thank you very much. Sorry, linear television, you've just gone.
If ThinkBox are listening to this podcast, there is a wee twitching at that. But I'm interested in what you're saying there. So in some of your members, when they are promoting the subscription models, are they actively folding into the offer statements around less advertising, less interest? Because you're acknowledging there is less advertising.
Yeah, I'm not seeing that. I mean, I'm sure it does form a part of some of the marketing messaging. Mm. I think that people are publishers are focusing more on emphasising the value and the quality of the content that you're paying for. It's very much a content-driven play. It's I think that the message to people is, usually we've given you a taster of the content, or you're a regular, you know, reader, and we've just introduced a paywall. You like it. You're an engaged consumer. This stuff costs money. You know, give us some of your money, and you can have access to not only this content but all this other great content that we're producing because you love it and you're an enthusiastic and engaged consumer. And I think that's, to begin with, that's absolutely the right marketing approach, because the whole of the direction of travel in terms of the strategy for this industry has been around engaging consumers and their passions around areas of interest, particularly specialist interest. So I don't think, you know, whilst a secondary message might be, oh, by the way, there's no ads, I don't think that's a primary message necessarily. It's about saying to somebody, we're connecting you with your passion, we understand your passion, you know that, we've demonstrated that to you. Now we're just asking you to pay something. And the great thing is that the average consumer now is getting used to paying for stuff on this kind of monthly rental basis. You know, if you've got Microsoft Office, it's 10 quid a month. If you've got Netflix, if you've got Spotify, if you've got iCloud, you know, all of these things are taking these £3, £5, £10.
That's a great point. To a certain degree, the the whole move towards a culture in which you buy access rather than own things is working in the favour of publishers, because the rest of the world is catching up with that model.
And you have to put it in context. I mean, the next iteration of the digital subscription snapshot, we're going to put in some charts around other streaming and other rental services and what their volumes are. And when you get into the fact, you know, there's the New York Times with 3.5 million paying subscribers. Great. Netflix have got, you know, whatever it is, 100 million or something. I mean, some, you know, bonkers number. So when you start to look at it in context, you go, well, hang on a second, we've done very well, but in comparison with some of the other,
although
entertainment
Netflix
services,
still don't make money even with 100 million subscribers.
Oh, sure.
But they've
had to, you know, build a content industry for it. They've had to build a content business from scratch. Mm. So in a very expensive field. So that doesn't surprise me. But that's the kind of positive aspect of that. Consumers are getting used to it. The negative aspect is that there are starting to be some concerns about subscription overload. In other words, how many of these things would the average consumer be prepared to bear? Particularly as this is the kind of first generation of consumers where this is the norm. If you sit down with your bank statement and you go, well, hang on a second, I've got, you know, Netflix, Spotify, Microsoft, New York Times, Washington Post, well, that's a lot, isn't it? It's 150 quid or something I'm paying every month. Don't need that one. Which ones are the ones that are going to drop out? People in the media and entertainment field are worried that that's us.
Yeah.
We're the disposable ones. And actually, you know, stuff like iCloud and things like that, of you know, where all my family photos are, well, that's not, I can't get rid of that.
Yeah.
That's my digital backup.
Mm.
You know.
Interesting. It's a really interesting report. And also, if people attempted to read the latest one, it's only like 12 or 14 pages long. So it's a coffee break long rather than a lunchtime long.
Oh, yeah,
long.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very to the point. A couple of quick questions I had. There's talk about within the report about dynamic paywalls. Almost a couple of sentences. What's the difference for a non-expert between a normal paywall and a dynamic paywall?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you know, in the early days of paywalls, these things were pretty hard. You know, they were there and you had to pay to get behind them. Then we had the metered paywall, you know, look at 5 articles and then you have to pay. The dynamic paywall is a kind of evolution of that, where we're using, or companies are using, particularly AI-driven software to determine a user's habits and to determine how likely it is that somebody is going to subscribe. And then they adjust both the pricing and the point at which the paywall messaging appears based on habit. So if I go to the Washington Post every day and look at 3 stories, the paywall is going to come up fairly quickly and say, you know, you're a pretty committed, engaged user. Can you give me your $5 a month or whatever it is? If I'm only going occasionally and I'm only looking at certain types of story, then it might come to me and say, well, actually, you only look at the opinion pages and you only look at them once a month. Just give us 99 cents and you look at that. So it's about tailoring. It's without a human's involvement. It's about tailoring your paywall offering to the consumer based on usage and demand. And it's a much more sophisticated way of getting somebody to subscribe.
Is that a system that could eventually end up with an option almost of micropayments, where you almost metered access?
Yeah. I mean, micropayments have been knocking around in the industry for a long time, and I don't want to insult my friends at Blendl and all the other people who do micropayments, but micropayments have never really taken off. I mean, there have been attempts to do it through micropayments using your credit card, using your phone bill.
Or blockchain.
blockchain, yeah. That's not really had any traction yet. My view, I think, is that micropayments for the average consumer are just too annoying. You know, it's just like, oh, yeah, okay. It's the classic thing in the subscription space. You don't want the consumer to have awareness of the transaction after the initial purchase. Mm. So you avoid telling them about anything to do with the fact that they've got a subscription unless you absolutely have to. In other words, unless you're putting the price up. Because the classic thinking is that the moment you tell a person that they subscribe to something, they remember and go, oh, yeah, that's 10 quid a month. I'll cancel that. You know, so with micropayments, you're having to do that every single time you transact. And that just puts this, you know, mental blocker on people of, well, I'm not going to pay that, I'm going to pay that. So I'm not sure that micropayments is necessarily the right thing. I think you're either in or you're out. And also from a consumer marketing point of view, if you're a media business, you want to have a relationship with the consumer. A micropayment is not a relationship. A micropayment is just a transaction. A subscription, even a 99-cent subscription, bearing in mind there's no marginal cost, of course, in digital subscriptions, is way better than a 99-cent purchase of an individual article. Yeah. So I think that you'll see. I think you will see that the majority of the push here, 90%, 95% of the push, is going to be towards permanent, monthly, recurring subscription.
Now, at the event in Lisbon, our focus, our particular focus, is on data, both trading currency data and also research to support insight and planning. I mean, looking forward to the event, what are you personally most hoping to get out of attending? I mean, what are the hot topics you're hoping that we're going to cover?
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting people from a broad range of industry, a broad range of the media industry. I mean, as I said, we have our roots in the magazine world. We're trying to go beyond that, so meeting new colleagues in television and radio and digital is always good. I think I'd be interested to know where the debate is in terms of the emergence of a standard currency for things like audience in the digital space, because in the publishing world we have made efforts to integrate audience measurement through things like PAMCO in the UK, which, you know, try to measure print and digital audiences for individual brands. You get a sense that as, you know, all media businesses now are trying to do everything. Therefore, at some point, the way we measure everything is going to converge. I'd be interested to know where we are with that convergence of audience measurement, particularly around digital subscriptions, of course, but around audience measurement for brands more broadly.
Mm. Excellent. Well, thanks for making time to speak to us today. We'll see you in Lisbon in September. And as I said, we'll put some details about how you can track down this report and find out more widely about what FIP get up to in the show notes for the actual show. So thanks for your time.
Thank you. Pleasure.